little clutch of slaves. In the interim, he had begun living with a woman who took in washing to boost their income. It may have been Levian's wish to marry this woman that abruptly prompted him to obtain an official divorce summons from Rachel on February 26, 1759. In a document seething with outrage, Levian branded Rachel a scarlet woman, given to a sinful life. Having failed to mend her ways after imprisonment, the decree stated, Rachel had absented herself from Levian for 9 years and gone elsewhere, where she has begotten several illegitimate children, so that such action is believed to be more than sufficient for him to obtain a divorce from her. Levian noted bitterly that he himself had taken care of Rachel's legitimate child from what little he has been able to earn, whereas she had completely forgotten her duty and let husband and child alone, and instead given herself up to whoring with everyone, which things the plaintiff says are so well known that her own family and friends must hate her for it. After this vicious indictment, Levian demanded that Rachel be denied all legal rights to his property. He warned that if he died before her, Rachel, as a widow, would possibly seek to take possession of the estate and therefore not only acquire what she ought not to have, but also take this away from his child and give it to her whore children. This was how Levian designated Alexander and his brother, whore children. He was determined to preserve his wealth for his one legitimate son, 13-year-old Peter. Rachel was undoubtedly stunned by this unforeseen vendetta, this throwback to a nightmarish past. Summoned to appear in court in St. Croix, she must have feared further reprisals from Levian and did not show up or refute the allegations. On June 25th, Levian received a divorce that permitted him to remarry, while Rachel was strictly prohibited from doing so. The Danish authorities took such decrees seriously and fined or dismissed any clergyman who married couples in defiance of such decisions. In one swiftly effective stroke, Levian had safeguarded his son's inheritance and penalized Rachel, making it impossible for her two innocent sons ever to mitigate the stigma of illegitimacy. However detestable Levian's actions, two things should be said in his defense. Rachel had relinquished responsibility for Peter and forced Levian to bring the boy up alone. Also, Levian subsequently witnessed legal documents for the Littons, Rachel's St. Croix in-laws, suggesting that her own family may have seen her life as less than blameless. In view of this lacerating history, Rachel probably never imagined that she would return to St. Croix, but a confluence of events changed that. In the early 1760s, Levian moved to Frederiksted, on the far side of St. Croix from Christiansted, and dabbled in real estate. Then, around 1764, Peter moved to South Carolina. So when James Hamilton received a business assignment in Christiansted in April 1765, he could have taken along Rachel and the two boys without fearing any untoward collisions with Levian. James Hamilton had continued to feed off his brother's Glasgow business connections. He served as head clerk for Archibald Ingram of St. Kitts, the son of a Glasgow tobacco lord of the same name. The Ingrams asked James to collect a large debt due from a man named Alexander Moir, who was returning to Europe and denied owing them money. The resulting lawsuit was to drone on until January 1766. In the meantime, Rachel and the boys took up residence in Christiansted. Thrust back into the world of her former disgrace, Rachel lived blocks from the fort where she had been jailed and no longer had the liberty of posing as Mrs. Hamilton. On the St. Croix tax rolls, she shows up under misspelled variants of Fawcett and Levian. Stripped of whatever cover of legitimacy had sheltered them, it would have become glaringly evident to Alexander and James Jr., for the first time, that they were natural children and that their mother had been a notorious woman. James Hamilton scored an apparent victory in the Moir case, then left St. Croix and deserted his family forever. Why this sudden exit? Did Rachel's scandalous reputation cause a rift in their relationship? Did Levian conduct a smear campaign and poison the air with innuendo? These scenarios seem unlikely given that James Hamilton never appeared on the St. Croix tax rolls, suggesting that he knew all along that he was a transient visitor. Alexander offered a forgiving but plausible reason for his father's desertion. He could no longer afford to support his family. Because James Jr., 12, and Alexander, 10, had attained an age where they could assist Rachel, James Sr. may have believed that he could wash his hands of paternal duties without undue pangs of guilt. More in sorrow than malice, Alexander wrote a Scottish kinsman 30 years later, "You no doubt have understood that my father's affairs at a very early day went to wreck, so as to have rendered his situation during the greatest part of his life far from eligible. This state of things occasioned a separation between him and me when I was very young." Alexander probably never set eyes again on his vagabond father, who stayed in the Caribbean, either lured by the indolent tropic tempo or ground down by poverty. Father and son never entirely lost touch with each other, but a curious detachment, an estrangement as much psychological as geographical, separated them. As we shall see, there is a possible reason why James Hamilton may have felt less than paternal toward his son, and Alexander less than filial toward him. For a woman once hounded from St. Croix in disgrace, Rachel exhibited remarkable resilience upon her return. As she ambled about Christiansted in a red or white skirt, her face shaded by a black silk sun hat, this handsome, self-reliant woman seems to have been fired by some inner need to vindicate herself and silence her critics. At this, she succeeded admirably, superseding James Hamilton as the family breadwinner. Already on August 1st, 1765, her wealthy brother-in-law, James Lytton, had bought her 6 walnut chairs with leather seats and agreed to foot the bill for her rent. Alexander later testified to the Lytton's indispensable largesse, saying that his father's departure threw me upon the bounty of my mother's relations, some of whom were then wealthy. Rachel's return to St. Croix had probably been premised on support from Anne and James Lytton, a hope that never quite panned out, as her in-laws were themselves besieged by successive problems. As prominent sugar planters, the Lyttons had enjoyed a leisurely life at the Grange, occupying a stone, great house with polished wooden floors, louvered blinds, paneled shutters, and chandeliers. Like many sugar plantations, it was a world in miniature, a compound that included slave quarters, a sugar mill, and a boiling house that produced molasses and brown sugar. Then, one by one, the Lytton children were overtaken by the curse that seemed to afflict everyone around Alexander Hamilton. Several years earlier, Anne and James's second son, James Lytton Jr., had formed a partnership with one Robert Holliday. This business venture failed so abysmally that one summer night in 1764, the bankrupt James Jr. and his wife climbed aboard the family schooner, herded 22 stolen slaves on board, and cast off for the Carolinas, while the less quick-witted Holliday was captured and jailed for nearly 2 years. Shattered by this scandal, James and Anne Lytton sold the Grange and in late 1765 moved back to Nevis, just months after Rachel and her 2 boys arrived in St. Croix from there. Within 1 year, Anne Lytton was dead, leaving Rachel as the last surviving Fawcett. Rachel took a 2-story house on 34 Company Street, fast by the Anglican church and school. Adhering to a common town pattern, she lived with her 2 boys in the wooden upper floor, which probably jutted over the street, while turning the lower stone floor into a shop selling foodstuffs to planters. Salted fish, beef, pork, apples, butter, rice, and flour. It was uncommon in those days for a woman to be a shopkeeper, especially one so fetching and, at 36, still relatively young. One traveler to St. Croix remarked, "White women are not expected to do anything here except drink tea and coffee, eat, make calls, play cards, and at times sew a little." In her enclosed yard, Rachel kept a goat, probably to provide milk for her boys. She bought some of her merchandise from her landlord, while the rest came from 2 young New York merchants, David Beekman and Nicholas Kruger, who had just inaugurated a trading firm that was to transform Hamilton's insecure, claustrophobic boyhood. No less than in Nevis, slavery was all-pervasive on St. Croix. "It was the source from which every citizen obtains his daily bread and his wealth," concluded one contemporary account, "with 12 blacks for every white." A decade later, a census ascertained that Company Street had 59 houses, with 187 whites and 427 slaves packed into breathless proximity. Since the neighborhood was zoned to incorporate free blacks and mulattoes, Alexander was exposed to a rich racial melange. Because her mother had died, Rachel now owned 5 adult female slaves and supplemented her income by hiring them out. The slaves also had 4 children. Rachel assigned a little boy named Ajax as a house slave to Alexander and another to James. This early exposure to the humanity of the slaves may have made a lasting impression on Hamilton, who would be conspicuous among the founding fathers for his fierce abolitionism. St. Croix had its picturesque side and its conical sugar mills, powered by windmills or mules that crushed the sugarcane with big rollers. During harvest time, the twilight glittered with fires from boiling houses that dotted the island. The coast around Christiansted was lined with soft green hills and punctuated by secluded inlets and coves. Early idealized prints of the town show 2 distinct moods: a smart military precision down near the fort and wharf with heaps of sugar barrels ready for export, and a slower, more sensual inland atmosphere with black women balancing large bundles on their heads. Though house slaves donned shirts and skirts, it wasn't unusual for 100 or 200 slaves to toil naked in a steaming field beneath the towering sugar stalks. By night, the whitewashed town of Christiansted, laid out in a formal grid by Danish authorities, erupted into a roaring, licentious bedlam of boisterous taverns and open brothels overflowing with rebels, sailors, and outlaws from many countries. So extensive was the sexual contact between whites and blacks that local church registers were thickly sprinkled with entries for illegitimate mulatto children. If Alexander Hamilton was exposed to abundant savagery and depravity, he also snatched distant glimpses of an elegant way of life that might have fostered a desire to be allied with the rich. The local atmosphere was not likely to breed a flaming populist. Poverty carried no dignity on a slave island. The big planters rode about in ornate carriages and shopped for imported watches, jewelry, and other European finery. Some oases of culture survived amid the barbarism. 2 dancing schools gave lessons in the minuet, while the Leeward Islands comedians served up a surprisingly varied fare of Shakespeare and Restoration comedy. Rachel tried to give her Spartan household a patina of civility. From a later inventory, we know that she had 6 silver spoons, 7 silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs, 14 porcelain plates, 2 porcelain basins, and a bed covered with a feather comforter. Of most compelling interest to our saga, the upstairs living quarters held 34 books, the first unmistakable sign of Hamilton's omnivorous, self-directed reading. Many people on St. Croix would have snickered at his bookish habits, making him feel freakish and contributing to an urgent need to flee the West Indies. From his first tentative forays in prose and verse, we can hazard an educated guess about the books that stocked his shelf. The poetry of Alexander Pope must have held an honored place, plus a French edition of Machiavelli's The Prince and Plutarch's Lives, rounded off by sermons and devotional tracts. If Hamilton felt something stiflingly provincial about St. Croix, literature would certainly have transported him to a more exalted realm. The boy could be forgiven his escapist cravings. In late 1767, Rachel, 38, uprooted her family and hustled them down the block to 23 Company Street. Then, right after New Year's Day, she dragged them back to number 34 and succumbed to a raging fever. For a week, a woman named Anne McDonald tended Rachel before summoning a doctor hearing on February 17th. By that point, Alexander, too, had contracted the unspecified disease. Dr. Hearing subjected mother and child to the medieval purgatives so popular in 18th-century medicine. Rachel had to endure an emetic and a medicinal herb called valerian, which expelled gas from the alimentary canal. Alexander submitted to bloodletting and an enema. Mother and son must have been joined in a horrid scene of vomiting, flatulence, and defecation as they lay side by side in a feverish state in the single upstairs bed. The delirious Alexander was probably writhing inches from his mother when she expired at 9 o'clock on the night of February 19th. Notwithstanding the late hour, 5 agents from the probate court hastened to the scene and sequestered the property, sealing off 1 chamber, an attic, and 2 storage spaces in the yard. By the day of the funeral, Hamilton had regained sufficient strength to attend with his brother. The two dazed, forlorn boys surely made a pathetic sight. In a little more than 2 years, they had suffered their father's disappearance and their mother's death, reducing them to orphans and throwing them upon the mercy of friends, family, and community. The town judge gave James Jr. money to buy shoes for the funeral and bought black veils for both boys. Their landlord, Thomas Dipnall, donated white bread, eggs, and cakes for the mourners, while cousin Peter Litton contributed 11 yards of black material to drape the coffin. As a divorced woman with 2 children conceived out of wedlock, Rachel was likely denied a burial at nearby St. John's Anglican Church. This may help to explain a mystifying ambivalence that Hamilton always felt about regular church attendance, despite a pronounced religious bent. The parish clerk officiated at a graveside ceremony at the Grange, the erstwhile Litton estate outside of Christiansted, where Rachel was laid to rest on a hillside beneath a grove of mahogany trees. There was to be no surcease from suffering for the 2 castaway boys, just a cascading series of crises. Heaps of bills poured in, including for the batch of medicine that had failed to save their mother. Less than a week after Rachel died, the probate officers again trooped to the house to appraise the estate. The moralistic tone of their report shows that Johann Michael Levian meditated further revenge against Rachel at the expense of her 2 illegitimate sons. The court decided that it had to consider 3 possible heirs. Peter Levian, whose father had divorced Rachel for valid reasons, according to information obtained by the court, by the highest authority, and the illegitimate James and Alexander, the obscene children born after the deceased person's divorce. The whole marital scandal was dredged up again, only now at an age when Alexander and his brother could fully fathom its meaning. At a probate hearing, Levian brandished the 1759 divorce decree and lambasted Alexander and James as children born in whoredom, insisting that Peter merited the entire estate, even though Peter hadn't set eyes on his mother for 18 years. Life had not improved for the embittered Levian, who had remained on a steep economic slide and served as janitor of a Frederiksted hospital. His second wife had died just a month before Rachel, and the couple had already lost the 2 children they had together. For a year after his mother's death, Alexander was held in painful suspense by the probate court, and perhaps absorbed the useful lesson that people who manipulate the law wield the real power in society. While he was awaiting settlement of the small estate, principally Rachel's slaves and a stock of business supplies, the court auctioned off her personal effects. James Litton considerately bought back for Alexander his trove of books. In light of Rachel's unhappy history with Levian, the final court decision seems foreordained. Alexander and James Hamilton were disinherited, and the whole estate was awarded to Peter Levian. In November 1769, no less implacably vengeful than his father, Peter Levian returned to St. Croix and took possession of his small inheritance, an injustice that rankled Alexander for many years. Peter had fared sufficiently well in Beaufort, South Carolina, to be named a church warden, the chief financial and administrative officer, in St. Helena's Parish the previous year, yet he couldn't spare a penny for the 2 destitute half-brothers orphaned by his mother's death. One sidelight of Peter Levian's return to St. Croix deserves attention, because he did something shocking and seemingly inexplicable for a 23-year-old church warden. He was quietly baptized. Why had he not been baptized before? One explanation is that Johann Michael Levian had painstakingly concealed his Jewish roots, but still did not want his son baptized. Peter's furtive baptism, as if it were something shameful, suggests that he felt some extreme need for secrecy. After Rachel died, her sons were placed under the legal guardianship of their 32-year-old first cousin, Peter Litton. Already a widower, Peter had stumbled through a string of botched business dealings, including failed grocery stores in Christiansted. His brother later insisted that Peter was insane. Life as a ward of Peter Litton proved yet another merciless education in the tawdry side of life for Alexander Hamilton. Litton had a black mistress, Ledya, who had given birth to a mulatto boy with the impressive name of Don Alvarez de Balesco. On July 16th, 1769, just when the Hamilton boys must have imagined that fate couldn't dole out more horrors, Peter Lytton was found dead in his bed, soaked in a pool of blood. According to court records, he had committed suicide and either stabbed or shot himself to death. For the Hamilton boys, the sequel was equally mortifying. Peter had drafted a will that provided for Ledya and their mulatto child, but didn't bother to acknowledge Alexander or James with even a token bequest. When a crestfallen James Lytton appeared to claim his son's estate, he tried to aid the orphan boys but was stymied by legal obstacles resulting from the suicide. On August 12, 1769, less than 1 month after Peter's death, the heartbroken James Lytton died as well. 5 days earlier, he had drafted a new will, which also made no provision for his nephews Alexander and James, who must have felt jinxed. Let us pause briefly to tally the grim catalog of disasters that had befallen these two boys between 1765 and 1769. Their father had vanished, their mother had died, their cousin and supposed protector had committed bloody suicide, and their aunt, uncle, and grandmother had all died. James, 16, and Alexander, 14, were now left alone, largely friendless and penniless. At every step in their rootless, topsy-turvy existence, they had been surrounded by failed, broken, embittered people. Their short lives had been shadowed by a stupefying sequence of bankruptcies, marital separations, deaths, scandals, and disinheritance. Such repeated shocks must have stripped Alexander Hamilton of any sense that life was fair, that he existed in a benign universe, or that he could ever count on help from anyone. That this abominable childhood produced such a strong, productive, self-reliant human being. That this fatherless adolescent could have ended up a founding father of a country he had not yet even seen seems little short of miraculous. Because he maintained perfect silence about his unspeakable past, never exploiting it to puff his later success, it was impossible for his contemporaries to comprehend the exceptional nature of his personal triumph. What we know of Hamilton's childhood has been almost entirely learned during the past century. Peter Lytton's death marked a fork in the road for Alexander and James, who henceforth branched off on separate paths. The latter was apprenticed to an aging Christiansted carpenter, Thomas McNabney, which tells us much about his limited abilities. Most whites shied away from crafts such as carpentry, where they had to compete with mulattoes or even skilled slave labor. Had James shown any real promise or head for business, it is doubtful that he would have been relegated to manual work. By contrast, even before Peter Lytton's death, Alexander had begun to clerk for the mercantile house of Beekman and Kruger, the New York traders who had supplied his mother with provisions. It was the first of countless times in Hamilton's life when his superior intelligence was spotted and rewarded by older, more experienced men. Before considering his first commercial experience, we must ponder another startling enigma in Hamilton's boyhood. While James went off to train with the elderly carpenter, Hamilton, in a dreamlike transition worthy of a Dickens novel, was whisked off to the King Street home of Thomas Stevens, a well-respected merchant, and his wife Anne. Of the five Stevens children, Edward, born a year before Alexander, became his closest friend, an intimate acquaintance begun in early youth, as Hamilton described their relationship. As they matured, they often seemed to display parallel personalities. Both were exceedingly quick and clever, disciplined and persevering, fluent in French, versed in classical history, outraged by slavery, and mesmerized by medicine. In future years, Edward Stevens was wont to remind Hamilton of those vows of eternal friendship which we have so often mutually exchanged, and he often fretted about Hamilton's delicate health. If their personalities exhibited unusual compatibility, their physical resemblance bordered on the uncanny, often stopping people cold. 30 years later, when Hamilton's close friend Timothy Pickering, then Secretary of State, first set eyes on Edward Stevens, he was bowled over by the likeness. "At the first glance," recalled Pickering, "I was struck with the extraordinary similitude of his and General Hamilton's faces. I thought they must be brothers." When Pickering confided his amazement to Stevens's brother-in-law, James Yard of St. Croix, the latter informed me that the remark had been made 1,000 times. This mystery began to obsess the inquisitive Pickering, who finally concluded that Hamilton and Stevens were brothers. In notes assembled for a projected biography of Hamilton, Pickering wrote that it was generally understood that Hamilton was an illegitimate son of a gentleman of the name of Stevens. This scuttlebutt resonated through the 19th century, so that in 1882 Henry Cabot Lodge could write that every student of the period is familiar with the story, which oral tradition had handed down, that Hamilton was the illegitimate son of a rich West Indian planter or merchant, generally supposed to have been Mr. Stevens, the father of Hamilton's early friend and schoolfellow. What to make of this extraordinary speculation? No extant picture of Edward Stevens enables us to probe any family resemblance. Nevertheless, in the absence of direct proof, the notion that Alexander was the biological son of Thomas Stevens instead of James Hamilton would clarify many oddities in Hamilton's biography. It might identify one of the adulterous lovers who had so appalled Levian that he had hurled Rachel into prison. It would also explain why Thomas Stevens sheltered Hamilton right after Rachel's death, but made no comparable gesture to his brother James. In the 18th century, illegitimate children frequently masqueraded as orphaned relatives of the lord or lady of the house, a polite fiction understood and accepted by visitors. This parentage would also explain why Hamilton formed an infinitely more enduring bond with Edward Stevens than with his own brother. It might suggest why James Hamilton Sr. left his family behind, assumed no further responsibility for them, and took no evident delight in Alexander's later career. Most of all, it would account for the peculiar distance that later held Hamilton apart from both his father and brother. As will be seen, Alexander Hamilton was an intensely loyal person, endowed with a deep streak of family responsibility. There is something telltale about the way that he, his father, and his brother let relations abruptly lapse, as if the three of them were in headlong flight from some harrowing shared secret. Chapter 2. Hurricane. Even in the languorous tropics, Hamilton, while clerking at Beekman and Kruger, was schooled in a fast-paced modern world of trading ships and fluctuating markets. Whatever his frustrations, he did not operate in an obscure corner of the world, and his first job afforded him valuable insights into global commerce and the maneuvers of imperial powers. Working on an island first developed by a trading company, he was exposed early on to the mercantilist policies that governed European economies. Beekman and Kruger engaged in an export-import business that provided an excellent training ground for Hamilton, who had to monitor a bewildering inventory of goods. The firm dealt in every conceivable commodity required by planters: timber, bread, flour, rice, lard, pork, beef, fish, black-eyed peas, corn, porter, cider, pine, oak, hoops, shingles, iron, lime, rope, lampblack, bricks, mules, and cattle. Amid his various engagements in later years, John C. Hamilton said of his father, he adverted to this time as the most useful part of his education. He learned to write in a beautiful, clear, flowing hand. He had to mind money, chart courses for ships, keep track of freight, and compute prices in an exotic blend of currencies, including Portuguese coins, Spanish pieces of eight, British pounds, Danish ducats, and Dutch stivers. If Hamilton seemed very knowing about business as a young adult, it can partly be traced to these formative years. Located above the harbor at the elevated intersection of King and King's Cross Streets, Beekman and Kruger ran a shop and adjoining warehouse. A pleasant stroll down the sloping main street would have brought Hamilton, freshened by sea breezes, to the hectic wharf area, where the firm maintained its own dock and ship. While the clerk inspected incoming merchandise, some of it contraband, the air was thick with the sweet fragrances of sugar, rum, and molasses, hauled in barrels by horse-drawn wagons and ready for shipment to North America in exchange for grain, flour, timber, and sundry other staples. The neutral Danish island served as a transit point to the French West Indies, converting Hamilton's ease in French into a critical business asset. As a rule, the merchants of St. Croix were natives of the British Isles, so that English, not Danish, functioned as the island's lingua franca. Beekman and Kruger furnished Hamilton with a direct link to his future home in New York, which carried on extensive trade with St. Croix. Many Manhattan trading firms dispatched young family members to the islands as local agents, and Nicholas Kruger was a prime example. He came from one of colonial New York's most distinguished families. His father, Henry, was a wealthy merchant, ship owner, and member of His Majesty's Royal Council for the province. His uncle, John Kruger, had been a long-standing mayor and a member of the Stamp Act Congress. While this blue-blooded clan had distinct Anglophile tendencies, time was to expose a split. Nicholas's brother, also Henry, based in Britain, was elected a member of Parliament from Bristol beside no less august a personage than Edmund Burke. Nicholas himself was to side with the rebel colonists and revere George Washington. One wonders whether he functioned as Hamilton's first political tutor. He also exposed Hamilton to a prosperous, civic-minded breed of New York businessmen who stood as models for the elite brand of federalism he later espoused. From the outset, the young Hamilton had phenomenal stamina for sustained work. Ambitious, orphaned boys do not enjoy the option of idleness. Even before starting work, he must have developed unusual autonomy for a 13-year-old, and Beekman and Kruger would only have toughened his moral fiber. Hamilton exuded an air of crisp efficiency and cool self-command. While his peers squandered their time on frivolities, Hamilton led a much more strenuous, urgent life that was to liberate him from St. Croix. He was a proud and sensitive boy, caught in the lower reaches of a rigid class society with small chance for social mobility. His friend Nathaniel Pendleton later said of his clerkship that Hamilton conceived so strong an aversion to it as to be induced to abandon altogether the pursuits of commerce. On November 11th, 1769, in his earliest surviving letter, the 14-year-old Hamilton vented the blackest pent-up despair. Written in elegant penmanship, the letter shows that the young clerk felt demeaned by his lowly social station and chafed with excess energy. Already he sought psychic relief in extravagant fantasies of fame and faraway glory. The recipient was his dear friend and look-alike Edward Stevens, who had recently begun his studies at King's College in New York. "To confess my weakness, Ned, my ambition is so prevalent that I condemn the groveling and conditions of a clerk or the like to which my fortune, etc., condemns me, and would willingly risk my life, though not my character, to exalt my station. I'm confident, Ned, that my youth excludes me from any hopes of immediate preferment, nor do I desire it. But I mean to prepare the way for futurity. I'm no philosopher, you see, and may be justly said to build castles in the air. My folly makes me ashamed, and beg you'll conceal it. Yet, Neddy, we have seen such schemes successful when the projector is constant. I shall conclude by saying I wish there was a war. Alex Hamilton." What prophetic aspirations Hamilton telescoped into this short letter. The boy hankering for heroism and martial glory was to find his war soon enough. He betrayed a stinging sense of shame that the adult Hamilton would studiously cloak behind an air of bravado. Of special interest are his intuitive fear that his outsized ambition might corrupt him and his insistence that he would never endanger his ethics to conquer the world. Despite some awkwardness in the writing, he appears surprisingly mature for 14 and springs full-blown into the historical record. He had ample opportunities to exercise his many talents. In 1769, David Beekman quit the business and was replaced by Cornelius Courtright, another New Yorker with another prestigious name, and the firm was reconstituted as Courtright and Kruger. In October 1771, for medical reasons, Nicholas Kruger returned to New York for a 5-month stint and left his precocious clerk in charge. A sheaf of revealing business letters drafted by Hamilton show him for the first time in the take-charge mode that was to characterize his tumultuous career. With peculiar zeal, he collected money owed to the firm. "Believe me, sir," he assured the absent Kruger, "I done as hard as is proper." The bulk of the correspondence concerns a sloop called the Thunderbolt, partly owned by the Krugers, that carried several dozen miserable mules through churning seas in early 1772. Hamilton had to direct this cargo safely along the Spanish Main, South America's northwestern coast, then brimming with hostile vessels. Hamilton did not hesitate to advise his bosses that they should arm the ship with 4 guns. He said flatly to Teilman Kruger, who oversaw family operations in Curaçao, it would be undoubtedly a great pity that such a vessel should be lost for the want of them. When the ship docked with 41 skeletal, drooping mules, Hamilton lectured the vessel's skipper in a peremptory tone that someday would be familiar to legions of respectful subordinates. Reflect continually on the unfortunate voyage you have just made, and endeavor to make up for the considerable loss therefrom accruing to your owners. The adolescent clerk had a capacity for quick decisions and showed no qualms about giving a tongue-lashing to a veteran sea captain. So proficient and eager to lead was he that he must have been slightly deflated when Nicholas Kruger returned to St. Croix in March 1772. Hamilton's apprenticeship provided many benefits. He developed an intimate knowledge of traders and smugglers that later aided his establishment of the U.S. Coast Guard and Customs Service. He saw that business was often obstructed by scarce cash or credit and learned the value of a uniform currency in stimulating trade. Finally, he was forced to ponder the paradox that the West Indian Islands, with all their fertile soil, traded at a disadvantage with the rest of the world because of their reliance on only the sugar crop, a conundrum to which he was to return in his celebrated report on manufactures. It may be that Hamilton's preference for a diversified economy of manufacturing and agriculture originated in his youthful reflections on the avoidable poverty he had witnessed in the Caribbean. While Courtright and Kruger mostly brokered foodstuffs and dry goods, at least once a year the firm handled a large shipment of far more perishable cargo. Slaves. On the slave ships, hundreds of Africans were chained and stuffed in fetid holds, where many suffocated. So vile were the conditions on these noisome ships that people on shore could smell their foul effluvia even miles away. On January 23, 1771, during Hamilton's tenure, his firm ran a notice atop the front page of the local bilingual paper, the Royal Danish American Gazette. Just imported from the windward coast of Africa and to be sold on Monday next by Messrs. Courtright and Kruger, at said Kruger's yard, 300 prime slaves. The following year, Nicholas Kruger imported 250 more slaves from Africa's Gold Coast and complained that they were very indifferent indeed, sickly and thin. One can only imagine the inhuman scenes that Hamilton observed as he helped to inspect, house, groom, and price the slaves about to be auctioned. To enhance their appearance, their bodies were shaved and rubbed with palm oil until their muscles glistened in the sunlight. Some buyers came armed with branding irons to imprint their initials on their newly purchased property. From the frequency with which Nicholas Kruger placed newspaper notices to catch runaway slaves, it seems clear that the traffic in human beings formed a substantial portion of his business. By the time Hamilton arrived on St. Croix, the burgeoning slave population had doubled in just a decade, and the planters banded together to guard against uprisings or mass escapes to nearby Puerto Rico, where slaves could secure their freedom under Spanish rule. In this fearful environment, no white enjoyed the luxury of being a neutral spectator. Either he was an accomplice of the slave system, or he left the island. To remove any ambiguity in the matter, the government in Copenhagen issued a booklet, the St. Croixian Pocket Companion, which spelled out the duties of every white on the island, duties that would have applied to Hamilton starting in 1771. Every male over 16 was obligated to serve in the militia and attend monthly drills with his arms and ammunition at the ready. If the fort fired its guns twice in a row, all white males had to grab their muskets and flock there instantly. On days when renegade slaves were executed at Christiansværn, the white men formed a ring around the fort to prevent other slaves from interfering. Any slave who attacked a white person faced certain death by hanging or decapitation, death that probably came as a blessed relief after first being prodded with red-hot pokers and castrated. Punishments were designed to be hellish so as to terrorize the rest of the captive population into submission. If a slave lifted a hand in resistance, it would be promptly chopped off. Any runaway who returned within a 3-month period would have 1 foot lopped off. If he then ran away a second time, the other foot was amputated. Recidivists might also have their necks fitted with grisly iron collars of sharp, inward-pointing spikes that made it impossible to crawl away through the dense underbrush without slashing their own throats in the effort. It is hard to grasp Hamilton's later politics without contemplating the raw cruelty that he witnessed as a boy, and that later deprived him of the hopefulness so contagious in the American milieu. On the most obvious level, the slave trade of St. Croix generated a permanent detestation of the system and resulted in his later abolitionist efforts. But something deeper may have seeped into his consciousness. In this hierarchical world, skittish planters lived in constant dread of slave revolts and fortified their garrison state to avert them. Even when he left for America, Hamilton carried a heavy dread of anarchy and disorder that always struggled with his no less active love of liberty. Perhaps the true legacy of his boyhood was an equivocal one. He came to detest the tyranny embodied by the planters and their authoritarian rule, while also fearing the potential uprisings of the disaffected slaves. The twin specters of despotism and anarchy were to haunt him for the rest of his life. Like Ben Franklin, Hamilton was mostly self-taught and probably snatched every spare moment to read. The young clerk aimed to be a man of letters. He may already have had a premonition that his facility with words would someday free him from his humble birth and place him on a par with the most powerful men of his age. The West Indies boasted few stores that sold books, which had to be ordered by special subscription. For that reason, it must have been a godsend to the culture-starved Hamilton when the Royal Danish American Gazette launched publication in 1770. The paper had a pronounced Anglophile slant, reflecting the fact that King Christian VII of Denmark was both first cousin and brother-in-law to King George III of England. Each issue carried reverential excerpts from parliamentary debates in London, showcasing William Pitt the Elder and other distinguished orators, and retailed gossipy, fawning snippets about the royal household. Having a potential place to publish, Hamilton began to scribble poetry. Once his verbal fountain began to flow, it became a geyser that never ceased. The refined wit and pithy maxims of Alexander Pope mesmerized the young clerk, and just as Pope wrote youthful imitations of the classical poets, so Hamilton penned imitations of Pope. On April 6, 1771, he published a pair of poems in the Gazette that he introduced with a diffident note to the editor. "Sir, I am a youth about 17, and consequently such an attempt as this must be presumptuous. But if upon perusal you think the following piece worthy of a place in your paper, by inserting it you'll much oblige your obedient servant, A.H." The two amorous poems that follow are schizophrenic in their contrasting visions of love. In the first, the dreamy poet steals upon his virgin love, who is reclining by a brook as lambkins gambol around her. He kneels and awakens her with an ecstatic kiss before sweeping her up in his arms and carrying her off to marital bliss, intoning, "Believe me, love is doubly sweet in wedlock's holy bands." In the next poem, Hamilton has suddenly metamorphosed into a jaded rake who begins with a shocking, Swiftian opening line, "Celia's an artful little slut." This launches a portrait of a manipulative feline woman that concludes, "So, stroking puss's velvet paws, how well the jade conceals her claws, and purrs. But if at last you hap to squeeze her somewhat hard, she spits her back up, prenez garde. Good faith, she has you fast." The first poem seems to have been composed by a sheltered adolescent with an idealized view of women, and the second by a world-weary young philanderer who has already tasted many amorous sweets and shed any illusions about female virtue. In fact, this apparent attraction to two opposite types of women, the pure and angelic versus the earthy and flirtatious, ran straight through Hamilton's life, a contradiction he never resolved and that was to lead to scandalous consequences. The next year, Hamilton published two more poems in the paper, now recreating himself as a somber religious poet. The change in heart can almost certainly be attributed to the advent in St. Croix of a Presbyterian minister named Hugh Knox. Born in Northern Ireland of Scottish ancestry, the handsome young Knox migrated to America and became a schoolteacher in Delaware. As a raffish young man, he exhibited a lukewarm piety until a strange incident transformed his life. One Saturday at a local tavern where he was a regular, Knox amused his tipsy companions with a mocking imitation of a sermon delivered by his patron, the Reverend John Rogers. Afterward, Knox sat down, shaken by his own impiety, but also moved by the sermon that still reverberated in his mind. He decided to study divinity at the College of New Jersey, later Princeton, under its president, Aaron Burr, an eminent divine and father of the man who became Hamilton's nemesis. It was almost certainly from Knox's lips that Alexander Hamilton first heard the name of Aaron Burr. Ordained by Burr in 1755, Knox decided to propagate the gospel and was sent to Saba in the Dutch West Indies. This tiny island near Nevis measured 5 square miles, had no beaches, and was solitary enough to try the fortitude of the most determined missionary. Rough seas girded Saba's rocky shores, making it hazardous for ships to land there. As the sole clergyman, Knox resided in a settlement known as the Bottom, sunk in the elevated crater of an extinct volcano. It could be reached only by climbing up a stony path. Knox left a bleak picture of the heedless sinners he was assigned to save. Young fellows and married men, not only without any symptoms of serious religion, but keepers of Negro wenches, rakes, night rioters, drunkards, gamesters, Sabbath breakers, church neglectors, common swearers, unjust dealers, etc. An erudite man with a classical education, Knox was starved for both intellectual companionship and money. In 1771, he visited St. Croix and was received warmly by the local Presbyterians, who enticed him to move there. In May 1772, he became pastor at the Scotch Presbyterian Church at a salary considerably beyond what he had earned inside his old crater. After the lonely years in Saba, the 45-year-old Knox felt rejuvenated in St. Croix. Humane and tolerant, politically liberal, he was to fervently support American independence, opposed to slavery, though he owned some slaves, and later author of several volumes of sermons, he held a number of views that would have attracted Hamilton. In his earliest surviving letter, he defended his confirmed belief that illegitimate children should be baptized and argued that clergymen should rescue them from their parents instead of rejecting them. He departed from a strict Calvinist belief in predestination. Instead of a darkly punitive God, Knox favored a sunny, fair-minded one. He also saw human nature as insatiably curious and reserved his highest praise for minds that created schemes or systems of truth. Then an illegitimate young clerk with an uncommon knack for systematic thinking stepped into his life. Knox must have marveled at his tremendous luck in discovering Hamilton. We do not know exactly how they met, but Knox threw open his library to this prodigious youth, encouraged him to write verse, and prodded him toward scholarship. An avuncular man with a droll wit, Knox worried that Hamilton was too driven and prone to overwork, too eager to compensate for lost time. A failing, if it was one, that he never outgrew. In later years, Knox liked to remind Hamilton that he had been rather delicate and frail, with an ambition to excel, and had tended to strain every nerve to be the very best at what he was doing. Knox had an accurate intuition that this exceptional adolescent was fated to accomplish great deeds, although he later confessed that Alexander Hamilton had outstripped even his loftiest expectations. Among his other gifts, the versatile Hugh Knox was a self-taught doctor and apothecary, and a part-time journalist who occasionally filled in for the editor of the Royal Danish American Gazette. It may have been at the newspaper office, not at the church, that he first ran into Hamilton. That Knox moonlighted as a journalist proved highly consequential for Hamilton when a massive hurricane tore through St. Croix on the night of August 31st, 1772, and carved a wide swath of destruction through nearby islands. By all accounts, the storm struck with unprecedented fury, the Gazette reporting that it was the most dreadful hurricane known in the memory of man. Starting at sundown, the gales blew like great guns for about 6 hours, save for half an hour's intermission. The face of this once beautiful island is now so calamitous and disfigured as it would beggar all description. The tremendous winds uprooted tall trees, smashed homes to splinters, and swept up boats in foaming billows and flung them far inland. detailed reports of the storm in Nevis where the destruction was comparable. Huge sugar barrels were tossed 400 yards. Furniture landed 2 miles away. Confirm its terrifying power. Nevis had also been struck by a severe earthquake that afternoon, and it seems probable that Nevis, St. Kitts, St. Croix, and neighboring islands were deluged by a tidal wave up to 15 feet high. The devastation was so widespread that an appeal for food was launched in the North American colonies to avert an anticipated famine. On September 6th, Hugh Knox gathered the jittery faithful at his church and delivered a consoling sermon that was published in pamphlet form some weeks later. Hamilton must have attended and been inspired by Knox's homily, for he went home and composed a long, feverish letter to his father, trying to convey the hurricane's horror. It is noteworthy that Hamilton was still in touch with his father more than 6 years after the latter's departure from St. Croix. That James Hamilton resided outside the storm area suggests that he was in the southern Caribbean, possibly Grenada or Tobago. In his melodramatic description of the hurricane, one sees the young Hamilton glorying in his verbal powers. He must have shown the letter to Knox, who persuaded him to publish it in the Royal Danish American Gazette, where it appeared on October 3rd. The prefatory note to the piece, presumably written by Knox, explained, "The following letter was written the week after the late hurricane by a youth of this island to his father. The copy of it fell by accident into the hands of a gentleman, who, being pleased with it himself, showed it to others to whom it gave equal satisfaction, and who all agreed that it might not prove unentertaining to the public." Lest anyone suspect that an unfeeling Hamilton was capitalizing on mass misfortune, Knox noted that the anonymous author had at first declined to publish it, perhaps the last time in Alexander Hamilton's life that he would prove bashful or hesitant about publication. Hamilton's famous letter about the storm astounds the reader for two reasons. For all its bombastic excesses, it does seem wondrous that a 17-year-old, self-educated clerk could write with such verve and gusto. Clearly, Hamilton was highly literate and already had a considerable fund of verbal riches. It seemed as if a total dissolution of nature was taking place. The roaring of the sea and wind, fiery meteors flying about it in the air, the prodigious glare of almost perpetual lightning, the crash of the falling houses, and the ear-piercing shrieks of the distressed were sufficient to strike astonishment into angels. But the description was also notable for the way Hamilton viewed the hurricane as a divine rebuke to human vanity and pomposity. In what sounded like a cross between a tragic soliloquy and a fire and brimstone sermon, he exhorted his fellow mortals, "Where now, O vile worm, is all thy boasted fortitude and resolution? What is become of thine arrogance and self-sufficiency? Death comes rushing on in triumph, veiled in a mantle of tenfold darkness, his unrelenting scythe pointed and ready for the stroke. See thy wretched helpless state and learn to know thyself. Despise thyself and adore thy God. O ye who revel in affluence, see the afflictions of humanity and bestow your superfluity to ease them. Succor the miserable and lay up a treasure in heaven." Gloomy thoughts for a teenage boy, even in the aftermath of a lethal hurricane. The dark spirit of the storm that he summons up, his apocalyptic sense of universal tumult and disorder, bespeak a somber view of the cosmos. He also shows a strain of youthful idealism as he admonishes the rich to share their wealth. Hamilton did not know it, but he had just written his way out of poverty. This natural calamity was to prove his salvation. His hurricane letter generated such a sensation, even the island's governor inquired after the young author's identity, that a subscription fund was taken up by local businessmen to send this promising youth to North America to be educated. This generosity was all the more remarkable given the island's dismal state. The hurricane had flattened dwellings, shredded sugarcane, destroyed refineries, and threatened St. Croix with prolonged economic hardship. It would take many months, maybe years, for the island to recover. The chief sponsor of the subscription fund was likely the good-hearted Hugh Knox, who later told Hamilton, "I have always had a just and secret pride in having advised you to go to America and in having recommended you to some of my old friends there." The chief donors were probably Hamilton's past and present bosses, Nicholas Kruger, Cornelius Courtright, and David Beekman, plus his guardian, Thomas Stevens, and his first cousin, Anne Lytton Venton. Possibly aware of Hamilton's early, indeed abiding, interest in medicine, the business community may have hoped to train a doctor who would return and treat the many tropical diseases endemic to the island. Doctors were perpetually scarce in the Caribbean, and Edward Stevens was already in New York preparing for such a career. In the standard telling of his life, Hamilton boards a ship in October 1772 and sails off to North America forever. Yet a close study of the Royal Danish American Gazette and other documents raises questions about this usual chronology. Hamilton may have been the Juvenis who published a poem, The Melancholy Hour, in the Gazette of October 11, 1772. This brooding work, "Why hangs this gloomy damp upon my mind? Why heaves my bosom with the struggling sigh?" reprises the theme of the hurricane as heavenly retribution upon a fallen world. On October 17th, the Gazette ran an unsigned hymn in imitation of Pope that incontestably came from Hamilton's pen and was later cherished by his wife as proof of her husband's religious devotion. Entitled The Soul Ascending into Bliss, it is a lovely, mystical meditation in which Hamilton envisions his soul soaring heavenward. "Hark, hark, a voice from yonder sky, methinks I hear my Savior cry. I come, O Lord. I mount, I fly, on rapid wings I cleave the sky." There is a third poem by Hamilton that has been overlooked and that appeared in the Gazette of February 3, 1773, under the heading Christiansted, a Character, by A.H. In this short, disillusioned verse, Hamilton evokes a sharp-witted fellow named Eugenio who manages inadvertently to antagonize all of his friends. The poem concludes, "Wit not well-governed rankles into vice. He to his jest his friend will sacrifice." The discovery of this poem, possibly influenced by an event in the life of Molière, bolsters the supposition that Hamilton spent the winter of 1772 to 1773 in St. Croix, although he could have mailed Hugh Knox the verse from North America. To understand this transitional moment in Hamilton's life, we must introduce yet another figure into the convoluted saga of his early years. His first cousin, Anne Lytton Venton, later Anne Mitchell. So incalculable was Hamilton's debt to her that on the eve of his duel with Burr, as he contemplated his life, he instructed his wife, "Mrs. Mitchell is the person in the world to whom, as a friend, I am under the greatest obligations. I have not hitherto done my duty to her." Why this guilt-ridden homage to a figure who has lingered in the historical shadows? 12 years older than Hamilton, Anne Lytton Venton was the oldest daughter of Rachel's sister Anne. Like so many figures in Hamilton's family, her life was a checkered one. In her early teens, she married a poor Christiansted grocer, Thomas Hallwood, and promptly had a son. After 1 year of marriage, Hallwood died. In 1759, Anne married the somewhat more prosperous John Kirwan Venton, who bought a small sugar estate. By 1762, his business had failed, and their home and effects were seized by creditors. The couple decamped to New York, leaving an infant daughter with Anne's parents. The Ventons evidently faltered in New York and were drawn back to St. Croix in 1770 after the suicide of Anne's brother Peter and the death of her father, James Lytton. If John Kirwan Venton hoped to lay hands on Anne's inheritance, he was foiled by the foresight of his father-in-law, who left 2/7 of his estate to Anne, but specifically excluded Venton from the money, calling him unfortunate in his conduct. At this point, the Venton marriage dissolved in acrimony, with Anne and her daughter occupying Peter's house in Christiansted while John took refuge in Frederickstead. After the hurricane, John Venton filed for bankruptcy again and posted a notice to his creditors. No less mean-spirited than Johann Michael Levien, Venton also placed the following threatening ad in the Gazette of May 15, 1773. "John Kirwan Venton forbids all masters of vessels from carrying Anne Venton or her daughter Anne Lytton Venton off this island." Defying this warning, Anne Venton and her daughter fled to New York, a brave act that would have reminded Hamilton of his mother flouting the odious Levien. To secure her inheritance, Anne entrusted the 18-year-old Hamilton with a power of attorney that allowed him to collect payments from her father's estate due on May 3rd and 26th and June 3rd, 1773. It may well have been after receipt of this money that he boarded a vessel bound for Boston, leaving the West Indies forever. Perhaps in gratitude for his assistance or else plain affection for her exceedingly bright cousin, Anne Lytton Venton repaid Hamilton by becoming a benefactor, quite likely the principal benefactor, of his voyage to North America and subsequent education. If so, Hamilton repaid the favor by aiding Anne financially in future years. He always felt under a more compelling obligation to her than to anyone else from his early years.